Lagos, of course. I'm sure you have a question for Mr. Jack Rich. And throughout the show, I'm going to be taking those questions from you as well. Now, let's start with a bit of introduction, Mr. Jack Rich. Tell Lagos who you are. Tell Lagos your background. Tell Lagos a bit about your track record.
Hello, my name is Thane Jack Rich. I'm from Rivers State in the south part of the country. And I've been in business for 24 years. I've been an oil and gas player. I started about 1998 as a service provider to multinational oil companies, especially companies operating outside the shores of Nigeria. And then I went into doing similar type of services for Nigerian-based oil company called Shell. So I did a lot of engineering work for them, provided a lot of manpower services and all this type of stuff. So I've been an upstream player. But prior to then, I also have worked in the oil field as an oil field, roustabout. I grew up from the rank of a roustabout all the way to a top mechanical, installation and a hookup specialist. But before then, my story dates back to, my childhood when I lost parental care at the age of 10. About 1983 and 84, my parents moved, back to the village. And as a young lad back in the village, helping my late mom, who was, a petty trader, buying and selling tomatoes and all those type of stuff, I discovered that it got to a point that life became so tough for her, because back in the days in the village, there wasn't potable water, no electricity, no medical care, no roads. From the city of Port Harcourt to my little village, I would travel by boat for like 12 hours, because it's an ocean community it's a community in an island. And somehow mother took ill and, she was taken to the hospital, but, because there was no support, no money to pay her medical bill, and she passed away. So, the hardest part of life was the oldest little boy who was just 10. And what I was doing was just to survive, going fishing today, the next day, get back home, paddling canoe for like all through the night till the next day. And as soon as you're able to make some cash, you paddle back home and, sell, make some sales out of it and then help yourself through school. So I was in the village till I was primary six at age 15, And after primary six, and I said to myself, listen, I need to get back to the city where I was born. So I decided to as a little boy, I decided to join the boat. I didn't even have, no cash on me to pay for the fare. So I was just a little boy walking on the boat up until we got to the city of Port Harcourt. So when I got to Port Harcourt, I disembarked the boat and just went into the city. But, just hearing the sound of cars and seeing people around, I said, this is where I was born. And I think this is where I belong.
Okay, but let's talk about a bit of your track record, because if we wanted to talk about your from when you were a child to when you were an adult, you gave us just 30 minutes. That's not going to be enough time to get into that. Let's fast forward to your track record, just a bit of that.
Yeah. So basically, having gone through the crucibles of life and all that, I was privileged to get a job. I was just one of those boys struggling in the city without, a sense of direction. And when, God remembered his son, I got employed, and from there I built skills. And my first employment was an oil and gas company where I was just trying to learn business skills so I can advance my course and build up a career.
Is there any politicking in that CV? Is there any politicking in that CV?
No. So from there, I built up my vision to have a special interest in the oil and gas. And having grown through the rank and file of the oil and gas and having established my own business, when I got into strong social intervention, helping communities and helping youth, providing scholarships and you know, building infrastructure that is like a state of the art and all that. In the course of doing that, I realized, you know, communities outside my hometown are also going through what my hometown went through and is going through. And the desire for a political office so I can have access to, you know, a more, you know, what I would call plenteous opportunity of a lot more was born.
Was that what made you decide to run for president?
Well, absolutely, because, you know, the opportunities to be able to give back to the country was born as a result of the desire to, you know, change the trajectory, because 2023 is a special year. And if you look at what is going on in the world today, you can see political leadership and economists are going through a lot of turmoil. So a do-nothing scenario for someone like me to get involved in politics will be a major disaster. And I believe I can give back to my country with the enormous amount of experiences and knowledge base that I have acquired.
But none of that is political experience. So you could have decided to keep facing the challenges in the business world, for instance. You own an oil company. What made you decide to change directions and face the political challenge?
Well, basically my country, you know, my country has given me the opportunity to be where I am. And the best way to give back to the country is to look at the needs that the country has and then ensure that I come on board and contribute my quota in terms of employment and policies to enable private sector growth and also policies that will also enable foreign investors to come in and invest, have a safe haven to invest, and policies that enables me to collaborate with state governments in line with the economic plan and policies to grow our economy, because whatever happens in a particular state affects our national rating. And not only that, we have a surging population that is growing at about 2.5%, and that population itself accounts for over 78% of the entire population is within the young age of, you know, 15 and about 45. So it's a surging young population that we have to provide, you know, a lot of employment opportunities for that population so we can have a safer environment and also a safer country.
Let's talk about how you're going to get it done, though, because apart from Olufalaye in 1999, every presidential candidate of a major party in the Fourth Republic has been a current or ex-president, a current or ex-vice president, or a current governor. And in large part, this is because political office holders dominate the party structures that control the delegates. So what's your plan for breaking that hold as a relative outsider?
Well, basically, I'm bringing to the table a special type of strategy that is outside the traditional political game changers or game movers. I'm a private sector operator. So basically what we're going to be dealing with in 2023 is a strong economic challenge. And you need an experienced industrialist who have gone through the crucibles of business and private life to be able to come in and take over leadership so we can create jobs. You know, creating jobs and creating the enablers to ensure that there is peace and all that has nothing to do with a former senator or a governor. It has to do with somebody who understands the cutting-edge human resource that will be able to take advantage of the opportunity that is available and then deal with the issues that is peculiar to the needs of the country. So I believe strongly that I'm bringing in a special skill set that the country really needs so that we can change the trajectory of the country and then move the country into an economic surplus where opportunities are made available for those who are dreamers.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying, but that seems to apply to the average voter, but not the people who are within your party. Because again, I said that a lot of the political office holders dominate the party structures that control the delegates. What's the strategy that you have for breaking that hold? Because again, like I said before, you are a relative outsider to politics and politicking.
Well, you know, the delegates themselves, they are like you and I. They want a better life. they want an improved life. They want a job. They have children that need employment. They have kids that are going to school. They can't afford to get it wrong. So they've been putting in this same guy in and out and trying to figure out how to get it right, but they've really not been able to get it right. So you need someone who is an outsider to come on board, who is an industrialist that understands what is called productivity.
How are you communicating it? How are you communicating that with the delegates and the people who they listen to?
I've spoken to a couple of the delegates, and I'm also engaging a lot more. We're having a visitation tomorrow. We had one a few days ago, and I'm using the same medium to speak to them because the traditional model hasn't changed the game. So we need to change that model. You need an innovator, a cutting-edge leadership that understands the global happenings and understands that we must not isolate. We have to integrate within the global economic pool to have access to the right technology to grow the right know-how so we can create jobs and make our country safer and investment friendly. You know, if you want to talk about large ticket investment in any country, you need foreign partnership, you need that collaboration. So you need those who have the technology and they have to trust you. So you need a president that has been there, that is doing it, that understands the language so they can come in and rule in their billions of dollars and invest. Not only that, you need a president that can also work with state governments to understand their economic policies and plan so those key economic footprints can be established at hotspot to deal with the issues. I tell you what, a lot of time we blame the president, but the president is not the cause of the problem. The governors are the ones responsible. The president does not share from the IGL of those states, neither does he award land, license or whatever. So we need a president in 2023 that understands this variable and that can also ensure that the governors also allow the local government to thrive. And then the fiscal, federalism that we also have is also enabled so that the local government will not be seen as what I call a dumping ground for, lack of opportunity. So there are some local government chairmen, I tell you, that don't even see what comes to their state in terms of revenue.
Yes, but before we get to when we elect a president, first there has to be primaries, right? And your party, the APC, is obviously yet to hold their primaries. And there's been a lot of talk from within your party that there's a need to postpone. Meanwhile, INEC is saying that the date is unmovable. Is the APC adequately prepared to hold primaries?
Absolutely. You know, in every big party such as APC will have, challenges. I mean, it's part of the political call, But, we don't have to make a lot of big deal about that. But I believe the party is ready and strong to conduct, internal democracy in such a manner that the best will be given. Now, you need to recognize that it's called APC, All Progressives Congress, a progressive party. So it's a party for people like Jack Rich, and it's a party for dreamers to realize our goal. So I believe strongly whatever you're seeing going on around is part of the flavor that a party such as, APC, will have to deal with. And it builds knowledge and competence and also that attraction for a lot more to come on board.
It's interesting you say that because I want to take you to River State. We saw reports yesterday of clashes at the state party headquarters. There's been a long-running factional crisis in the state party, which even stopped the party from fielding a Guba candidate in 2019. What are the root causes of this crisis? What, in your opinion, needs to be done to resolve it?
Well, I think you're going to be having divergent interests when it comes to the serious party that is controlling the center. So I believe strongly whatever the issues are, they're going to resolve it. The party is pretty much united and strong. They are different interest groups and all that, but all these things are going to be worked out. The party has a structure. There is an appeal committee that is there. They're going to look at all these petitions, and I tell you, justice will be delivered.
Okay. Let me come back to your background of oil and gas. I want to talk quite a bit about the different problems in that sector. First of all, the federal government has been lamenting all year that oil revenue is down because of oil theft. What are the systemic factors that have made government unable to checkmate oil theft and have allowed it to grow to the point that not enough oil is flowing to fund the budget?
Well, you know, in every business, you have the intrigues, you have the dynamics, and you have the ups and downs, you have the technical issues and all the stuff in terms of managerial understanding and leadership. So this is not different. You know, we have a whole bunch of youths that need to be engaged, and we believe strongly that the federal government is putting a lot of infrastructure in place to address those needs. But I'll tell you what, 2023 will be pretty much, you know, more dynamic and innovative in a manner issues like this are addressed. I've got a lot of experience in dealing with stuff like this, but in 2008 and 2010, we had similar problems, you know, and all the challenges were resolved. I'll tell you what was so unique that part of my, I was involved, on the front line of it. And we came up with several, you know, strategy, and we got it right. But a lot of these problems isn't the federal government, I'll be very honest to you. The operators are the ones who are licensed to deal with these issues.
Operators so such as yourself?
Such as myself. You know, so the federal government is not a cause of the problem. So as operator, you have the license to operate, meaning that you have the financial, technical, and you know, relationship know-how to deal with the issues. A lot of these youths have been employed. And when you go to their communities and carry out activities and you pollute their land, they will agitate, will look for a compensation. And a lot of time, instead of dealing with the issues, they run to the federal government and complain. And then they create issues. So I believe strongly that the issues will be resolved very, very soon. And the only way we can do that also is to create that integration within the operators, the local community, and expanded stakeholders.
So the
management process becomes cutting edge, and then you can deal with the core issues that, you know, the locals are talking about. And then the operators also need to be fair in a manner they address those social issues, because the time has changed. The operational methodology 25, 30 years ago is different from now. Now you're dealing with an era that, you know, you have a bunch of exposed young boys and girls. Communities are more aware. We are living in the smart age. Internet of Things is now the engine that is driving information and all that. So they know what you're doing in Europe. They know what you're doing in North and South America and all that part of the world. So they want to be treated fairly. So you also need to adjust your operational pattern so that you can, you know, capture a lot of this interest that is creating this agitation that is making us lose a lot of, you know, revenue.
Hmm. What would you do differently if you were, let's say, what should the next president do? What should the next president do to tackle this problem effectively?
What I'm going to do differently is that I'm going to create that integration and ensure that our traditional and contemporary operational model fits, you know, the interests of the local people and also the environment. We also need to ensure that we reduce greenhouse gas emission by ensuring that you know, a lot of these pollutions and all these stuffs that are really ravaged a lot of these local communities are addressed, and also a lot of these equipments are really timed out, you know, and we need to address them, and then taking advantage of
How will you address them? Because everyone knows they need to be addressed. The sticking point is always the how. So how will you address them?
So the first thing we're going to do is, you know, during my declaration, I talked about creating about 26,000 jobs in every local government area. And I also talked about investing within, you know, 300,000, 150 to 300,000 naira per person. What we're going to do is to create job opportunity for these youths within these local communities. They're going to strong surveillance and patrol. We're training them to have skills so they can watch about the infrastructure and all that, identify leak points, not only that. We'll also train them with certain type of technical skills so they become part of the operation technically. And then they have that sense of self-dignity and pride that they are also a key stakeholders of the wellness of their environment and the growth of business and all that. So we will train a lot of these guys and letting them own up the process and then investing in them too, so that they can, you know, provide food on the table and also aspire a greater high, like I'm doing right now.
Isn't global best practice to use technology, not humans?
Well, that's what I talked about, integration. You know, technology without the human involvement will amount to expression of technical rascality that I believe that won't lead us, you know, too far. We deploy equipment, we deploy, you know, human resources, and then also technology. The integration of these very sensitive methodology will go a long way to also assure the people that, listen, you know, that they need jobs and they know their importance and they are part of the value chain.
Why is that not happening right now? If you ask the current administration, they'll probably tell you the funds are simply not there. And Nigeria's fiscal situation continues to get worse and worse. So considering our fiscal reality, where are you going to get the money from to do all of these trainings and get all of this surveillance equipment that you're talking about, all of these big plans you have? How will you fund it?
So if you measure the quantum of value that you lose, it's nothing compared to what I'm talking about spending. You know what I'm trying to say? So if you look at right now, if you don't do nothing, you deplete your reserve, you deplete your environment, and then you create you allow a lot of unemployment to surge because the population is also surging. And then you also, the ripple effect of that is that you have high inflation because demand will outrun supply, and not only that, your currency will continue to devalue, and then you are nowhere. So the best is to tackle and take the bull by the jugular. So the best way of getting this done, I'll tell you, is to train a lot of these young boys who are doing nothing, and then spread them through this operational value chain, and you save a lot. You're going to spend less than 10% of what you're losing right now to create that amount of employment and deal with the issues. And then your environment is cleaner, your reserves are safer, you're able to get a lot of value from what you produce. And, your country rating goes higher as your credit also improves.
Okay, so I'm hearing something that sounds like a priority or something that the next president should prioritize. We've got 1 minute left from the time you gave us. So what issues do you think the next president should prioritize? You've talked about this oil theft situation. You've answered that. Talk to me about other things you think the next president should prioritize.
Well, I think what I'm going to be doing in 2023 is creating massive employment. You know, that's one of the smartest ways to deal with the social issues.
How?
The challenges in the Northwest, which is banditry and kidnapping, will continue. The farmers' headers clutches is also there as a major challenge that we're going to be dealing with. Militia group in the Northeast, also part of what we're going to be dealing with. And the agitators in the Niger Delta are there. We're going to deal with environmental.
How will you create the employment? How will you do it? That's what I want to hear. How?
So basically, first we have to train, we have to train a lot of these youths and let them have the requisite skills to be able to add to the value chain. Not only that, we will also invest a lot in building, local intelligence. It's part of the training of what I call community surveillance and all that, and border protection, border security through the conventional and the traditional model, making sure that the local communities, the chiefs, are all part of the value chain at leadership level, and also making sure that we don't deplete our servicemen and women who are putting a lot of their time and still struggling to get things right in 2023. So that integration is going to be there. Not only that, we can't do all this without the revenue stream. And that is why I'm saying that as an experienced oil and gas operator, my strategy will be to plug those swamps, drain our ability to realize the revenue that we're losing, and then converting that into the development plan that I have, which is creating a lot of employment, training the youth, and also making sure that they're able to produce what we consume within the local environment, and then employing technological know-how and training them with the right equipment. So they can have to our national value.
What employment gaps do you believe exist in the value chain which youths can currently be trained to fill?
Well, basically, you know, we need a lot of skills. For example, in the agricultural sector, as soon as we industrialize it, you know for sure what that means. Not only that, in services, we have a lot of skills that are required. And also in the production industry, we have a whole lot of skills that is required to go into manufacturing. So there are so many skills that I tell you that we will be training a lot of our young boys and girls to fit in line with our consumption demand and our unique needs.
Industrialization of agriculture and production for manufacturing require investments in electricity, also require a lot of infrastructure. Our infrastructural deficit at the moment is outrageous, and we're dealing with that alongside a fiscal reality that is a nightmare. How will you balance all of that? Because it's a tight rope to walk.
No, I tell you, if you look at the amount of energy that the oil and gas is currently losing, it's a lot. Because right now, when you produce the oil, you have gas, you have water, you have oil. You know what I'm saying? Right now, you flare the gas, that's a lot of energy that you lose. And we still import the gas that we consume. So the strategy is that the gateway will be enabled, plug the swamp that is currently draining what we are producing that we're not seeing. And then the excess value of that is used to procure the right technology to industrialize the oil and gas sector also, so that we'll be able to, warehouse a lot of energy to supply those industrial value chain that we need in line with state economic plan. Every state in this country should be able to have access to, gas energy so that you can have those hotspots and then produce the energy that you need. You know, decentralize energy production in such a manner that in line with your unique need, you can grow what you need and then, you know, supply your market. Not only that, renewable energy is also important. So renewable energy from solar, wind and biofuel and all that, biomass. You are based in Lagos, see a lot of those waste material that is just littering everywhere. That can be converted into renewable energy. So that strategic integration of this unique value chain is what we will bring to the table. But the key catalyst is oil and gas. We have a lot of oil that we produce that is not seen, but because of a few technical challenges that the operators are struggling with. So my leadership will bring this to the value chain, and then we dip it on the board, and we'll provide the right technical solution that's my strong area, and we'll begin to see a lot of savings and gain generated from the oil and gas sector.
All right, let's leave it at that. Thank you so much, Mr. Tane Jack Rich, for your time. Mr. Tane Jack Rich is a presidential aspirant contesting for the nomination of the All Progressives Congress. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck at the primaries, and we hope that we see you again soon.
Thank you very much.